gave him the spinning refresh circle. He'd never seen the circle on the app before. He switched to FaceTime, but it was moving so slowly he gave up before it even fully loaded. It crossed his mind to try a more direct route. He set the tablet down and unclipped the phone from his shirt. He tried Kevin first. A recorded voice told him all circuits were busy and asked him to try again later. He tried again right away and got the same message. On the third time, the call didn't even connect. He called his mom in Portland on both her numbers. Then he tried to call Jer in upstate New York, close to Buffalo. His ex, Lacey, lived in Los Angeles. They all got the same results. A dull recording or the silence of a dead circuit. He remembered being in school on 9/11. The math teacher, Mr. McAllister, trying to keep the class calm while he made call after call on his cell phone. It had been a flip phone. Doug remembered being worried by the idea that such a high-tech phone couldn't reach anyone. He skimmed through more of his phone numbers, offices, pizza parlors. He debated calling the Thai place near his apartment and seeing if they knew anything. He still had a number for another ex-girlfriend in Oakland, across the bay from San Francisco. It hadn't ended well, but he'd never deleted her number for some reason. Probably she was the only person he knew in the Bay Area, and he wanted to keep a potential couch-surfing contact, even if the odds were slim. He tried calling anyway. It rang. Halfway through the third ring, Autumn's panicked voice blasted out of the phone.
Doug?
Are you okay?
I think so. It's just, I can't get hold of anyone. I've been trying for hours.
I know, me either. I still had your number, so I tried.
Thank you. Thank you. Where are you?
I'm traveling. I'm out by Madagascar, I think, the other side of the world. Is one of them there? He figured she'd know what he meant by them.
Yes. It's just going back and forth across the city like it's grazing, like it's at a fucking buffet.
Her shout echoed over the phone from the other side of the world. Are you safe?
It's eating people. I saw the news and it's eating everyone in the city. It got, what's her name, the morning woman from Channel 7. She was reporting on the scene an hour ago and it just reached down and grabbed her head and pulled her up into the sky. The cameraman followed her for a minute and then he ran off. He left her to get eaten.
It sounds like he couldn't do anything, mumbled Doug.
It's eating everything. It's eating people and dogs and cats and trees.
The phone went silent for a few heartbeats before her voice returned.
A whole streetcar full of people.
I lost you for a minute, he said. Autumn, are you safe? Do you still have your car? Can you head up to Portland or somewhere away from it? The phone stayed silent. Doug glanced at the screen and realized he'd lost the call. He still had a signal. It had gone dead on her end. Maybe the thing in San Francisco had eaten a cell tower. Maybe a bunch of cell towers. Maybe it sucked up cell phone signals the way it had sucked up ocean water. He clipped the phone back on his collar, popped another snack in his mouth, and picked up his tablet. A few seconds of scrolling found him a video of the tentacled monster working its way through San Francisco. He tried to figure out which way it was headed and how far it was from Oakland. He told himself Autumn would be fine. She was smart. She'd calm down and get out of the city. Doug swished his fingers across the pad, pushing the San Francisco monster away. He touched another image and brought Shanghai back to full screen. Someone had apparently declared airstrikes were the thing to use against the creature. They seemed to be doing more damage to the buildings than the creature itself. They didn't even tear the thin skin of its wings. But the missiles kept coming, and it kept ignoring them. Whenever fire touched it, the flames just smothered and vanished.
What are you watching?
Seth stood behind him, looking over his shoulder. Doug's conversational reflexes lunged forward, long rehearsed mini lectures on privacy and personal space, but they stumbled on his tongue and his brain froze up. It, he started to say, and then just blurted out.
They're everywhere. All over the world.
Seth scowled.
How many of them?
Doug shook his head.
I don't know, a lot.
I think they're on every continent. Doesn't look like there's ever more than one of them, but they're in cities. Just one does a lot of damage. They've killed a lot of people. Seth started to respond, and then his lips just twisted up as he stared at the screen.
So this is all live?
A lot of it, yeah.
So the woman, Vic, she can make her call? Get us out of here?
I mean, if I stay right here, we've got a signal, but...
Good. Bug.
What?
Seth pointed. You have a bug on you.
One of the bright green cockroaches took slow steps across Doug's free hand, crossing the fleshy triangle between his thumb and finger. It wiggled its antennae at him. He flicked his hand and sent it scurrying away with a shudder. Seth grunted out something like a laugh, and then his head snapped up away from the tablet. Doug heard the thud of footsteps, the rustle of grass, and the snap of thin wood. He took three hasty steps past Seth, putting the sailor between him and whatever was coming out of the woods. He may have screamed as he did it and tried to listen for an echo as he turned around. Seth had his pistol out and aimed at a man a dozen yards away, still in the shadows of the forest. The man rocked back on his heels, having come to a sudden stop, and lifted his hands up above his head. He kept his fingers pressed tight together, Doug noticed, like someone getting ready to do some kind of karate chop.
Who are you? Hey, the man called out. Not me, I'm not a threat.
His eyes were covered by glossy John Lennon sunglasses, and his dark hair had the messy look of having gotten wet and dried on its own two or three times. His face was smooth and whisker-free, which Doug always viewed suspiciously in this day and age.
Who are you? Seth repeated. I'm Murdoch. Is that a pistol? Toss it over here.
I'd rather not pull it out and give you an excuse to shoot me.
What are you doing here?
I'm looking for someone. A woman. Doug remembered the name Vic had used, the oddly emphasized one. Are you part of the family? Murdoch said nothing, but his sunglasses flickered twice in the dim light. It took Doug a moment to register what he'd seen, and then another two for his brain to accept it. The glossy lenses looked back and forth from him to Seth.
Oh, fucking hell,
gasped Doug. Seth tightened his grip on his pistol, and his finger quivered over the trigger.
Murdoch held his hands a little higher and blinked his dark, round fish eyes again.
I swear, I'm not a threat.
27. Katanga's shoulder settled against the wet sand, and he released his death grip on the life vest. A wave splashed over him. The ocean made one final attempt to drag him back and settled for the life vest instead. It spun away into the night, then came back to give him a farewell tap on the elbow before retreating again. He clawed at the mud with numb fingers and dragged himself halfway out of the water. His arms felt like sandbags, clumsy, senseless. He swung one out in front of him and moved a few inches closer to the dry sand. The lifeboat had carried him almost a third of the way to the island, its interior ankle deep in water, before the engine had sputtered and died. The lights had dimmed and faded minutes later, as if just being near the great creature had leached away all the boat's energy. The fuel tank was full, but the gas smelled off. Sour. Katanga had had a brief hope the waves would take him closer to the island, but the ocean currents had gone mad. The lifeboat would spin, shift directions, and every second or third shift would drag him back toward the thing in the sky. Just before the monster completed its massive, supertanker-sized turn, he dug a life vest out of the onboard stores. He'd abandoned ship, again, making himself a smaller target, and tried to guide himself toward the distant island, even as the ocean sapped his body heat, little by little. He'd looked back later and the lifeboat had vanished from view, maybe hidden by waves in the dark, maybe sunk. He hadn't risked putting the vest on, either. If the thing came back, he wanted to be able to dive out of sight as quickly as possible. He didn't know if he could go deep enough to make a difference, but he knew he'd prefer drowning to ending up like the rest of Makara's crew. And now? A little less than 3 hours after abandoning Makara, here he was. Nauseous, shivering with cold, a lump of flesh on the shore of the island. Katanga opened and clenched his fingers again and again. He couldn't feel them, but he could see them. He ordered them to move until they obeyed, kept moving them until they were filled with pins and needles. He squeezed his fists until he felt his nails digging into his palms. Then he hauled himself up onto his forearms and crawled the rest of the way onto the beach. He collapsed into the sand. It still held a little of the day's heat, and he pushed his hands into it, burying his prickling fingers until they settled down. He tried to repeat the clenching process with his feet. He couldn't feel his toes, but a few nerves in his thighs told him his boots were shifting up and down. He tried to squeeze harder and bent his knees, letting his feet drop down onto the sand. The impact made his legs tremble. He pushed himself up onto his hands, then back into a kneeling position. The winds bouncing across the waves chilled his skin, and his wet clothes held the cold tight against his body. He shivered, beat his fists against his arms, and lurched to his feet. He made it 4 strides before his head spun, his gut wrenched itself into a knot, and a bolt of nausea knocked him back to his knees. He spat up a few mouthfuls of seawater he didn't remember swallowing, then waited to see if anything else followed it. His stomach rewarded him with more seawater. He couldn't remember when he'd last eaten something. His insides calmed and steadied themselves. A few deep breaths banished the dizziness. Katanga struggled back to his feet and walked, stiff-legged, up the beach. The air warmed just a few yards from the water, and gravity pulled some of the water from his clothes. His knees loosened and his stride relaxed as he made his way farther from the water. And then, his left leg dropped out from under him and he was face first on the ground again. At least his arms and hands had recovered enough to take most of the impact. He spat out some sand and rolled over. The uneven ground pushed up at his back. He shook the landing from his wrists, cursed passionately in 2 different languages, and got back to his feet yet again. The moon hadn't risen yet, or if it had, a cloud hit it. Either way, the beach was little more than shadows and outlines to his tired eyes. He looked north along the shoreline, then south. The camp would be somewhere nearby. Iman and Seth had come here from Makara, so they should have landed in the same general area, somewhere along this side of the island at least. Maybe not right on the shore, but not too far from it either. They'd have food, blankets, maybe even a fire. Katanga would be thrilled with any one of those right now. All 3, and he might just die a happy man. The thought sent a different chill through him, one that crawled just under the skin. Katanga looked up at the sky. A few clouds, a lot of stars, but nothing else up there. He swept his eyes back and forth but couldn't see any sign of a vast shadow. No pounding wings or reaching tentacles. It had to be off making another one of its 3 or 4 mile wide turns. He wanted to be deep in the forest, as far from shore as possible by the time it got back, preferably on the other side of the island, in the Zodiac, heading for another major shipping lane. Where was the Zodiac? He peeled off his sopping wet hoodie as he looked north and south again. He couldn't see the inflatable boat in either direction, or a campfire, or even an electric torch. He twisted the hoodie, and water splattered on the sand. 4 more twists, a good shake, and then 2 twists the other way before he struggled back into it. It was still wet, but it weighed 1 pound or 2 less, and the breezes didn't cut through it as fast. Still no sign of the Zodiac. No sign of them at all. Of course, he couldn't see all of the island's east shore from here. He couldn't even be sure this was the east shore. Just enough clouds dotted the sky to keep the key stars from him. Maybe a current had moved him north or south so gradually he didn't realize it. He thought about calling out, but his throat still burned with salt water and stomach acid. He didn't think he'd get more than one or two yells, and he might need them later. Plus, Katanga didn't feel a great desire to draw attention to himself. After being in the presence of the great beast, being witness to its raw hunger and appetite, he never wanted to be noticed again. He thought of Kazuya and Mr. Onyango and Hagen, all plucked away before his eyes, all dead. No shouting. He'd have to find them the old-fashioned way. Which direction? North? South? Into the woods? He moved closer to the tree line, rubbing his arms as he did. He didn't want to travel out in the open, but stumbling through the forest at night also didn't seem like a clever path of action. Then again, if Iman and the others had set up a sheltered camp any distance into the forest, Katanga might not see it from the beach, even if they had a campfire. He took a few more shambling steps, and his boot kicked something just beneath the sand. It burst free and skidded into the tall grass near a tree. He plodded over, crouched, oh, the ache in his legs, and found the little thing. The shape was about the size of a paperback book, maybe an inch thick, at the center. He guessed the stringy wood came from one of the island's palm trees. Water damage had frayed it apart at some points, but the remaining edges were polished smooth. He turned it once, flipped it over, and turned it again. A bear. Someone had cut and carved the wood into a simple teddy bear, and, judging from the well-worn edges, a much-loved one. It might have been painted once, but any color had long since been claimed by nature and time, leaving nothing but the shape and etched details. Katanga set it back down, propped up against the tree to stare at the ocean with its little wooden eyes. Taking the bear as a sign, he moved cautiously into the woods. 28. Chase heard the scream from outside and looked for the door. Wires, cables, and long strips of metal covered the interior walls, and it took him a moment to find the way out. He recognized the door frame by the shape more than anything, spotted the latch, and yanked it open. Night had fallen outside. The light from the door spilled out behind him as he half-jumped down the steps. Another shadow joined his on the stoop, either Veek or Alex following him out, maybe both of them. By the time he reached the bottom step, he'd spotted Seth and Doug, a third man, too, who Seth had at gunpoint. They led him into the clearing. "Who's he?" asked Chase. Doug took a few cautious steps back, keeping a safe distance from the stranger. "He says his name's Murdoch. He has a gun. I think he's one of those family cultist people Veek told us about." The stranger, Murdoch, perked up at mention of Veek. He turned his head to look at Chase, then shifted to look behind him.
"You're safe," Murdoch said. "Good."
"No thanks to you," came the reply from Veek.
"Is he one of them?" Chase asked. "The family?"
"Yeah. He's one of the ones who kidnapped me."
She pushed past Chase and marched over to the prisoner. Murdoch cleared his throat.
"Technically," he said, "I didn't have anything to do with your kidnapping, not directly anyway."
"Are you seriously mansplaining my abduction to me?"
I tried to protect you as best I could."
"Oh, I guess I missed that. Did it happen during the 5 days I had a bag over my head?"
"It was only 4 days, and it was a blindfold." Murdoch tilted his head. "And gag."
"Not helping your case."
"Look, I'm sorry."
"Well, that makes it all better, then."
"If he's here, should we be expecting others?" asked Chase as he moved closer. Then he got a good look at Murdoch's face.
"Jesus."
"Yes," said Seth. He's some kind of freak or something.
That's kind of offensive language, Doug said. Sorry, reflex response.
Shut up. No, he's right, said Murdoch. It's pretty offensive. You shut up too, said Seth, jabbing his pistol at the man.
I told you, said Veek. He's part of the family.
Family of what?
The family of the Red Death, said Murdoch. I just told you to shut up.
Chase leaned to the left, trying to get a better look at Murdoch's half-shadowed face.
You didn't mention they were werefish or something.
Murdoch sighed.
Some of them can pass for human, said Veek. The one leading them, Anne, could probably be a model, but about half of them are like this.
So they're monster people?
Sort of. Some of them more than others.
Do they have something to do with the monster people here?
Asked Seth.
The ones in the forest.
The seraphs?
Distant relatives, Murdoch said. Very distant. Last warning. Shut up.
You asked. Chase looked out at the dark forest.
We should probably tie him up and get him inside out of sight. We don't want him signaling to the others.
No signals, seriously. I'm on your side.
Veek snorted. Chase leaned in close to Murdoch, took hold of the pistol on the man's hip, and tried to wiggle the holster off his belt. It was a better holster than the worn, second-hand ones Seth and Iman had. Murdoch kept his hands up and didn't resist at all. When it came free, Chase stepped back and met the man's eyes. This close, he could see the edge of white on either side of Murdoch's eyes. Not fish eyes, just large and wide with dark pupils, as if they were dilated so far the color couldn't be seen. They reminded Chase of a live-action anime movie he'd seen a few months back on a cargo ship with an extensive, up-to-date HD DVD collection, the kind of thing Dina would have gone nuts for. The lead character had been a cyborg with eerily oversized eyes that made her seem inhuman, despite everything else about her. Murdoch's eyes were like that. Not exactly monstrous, just inhuman. Chase stepped away with the pistol.
Seth, you still have those handcuffs?
Yes.
Check his pockets, said Veek. He had me locked up before, he might have the keys.
I do, offered Murdoch. It's in my left pocket.
Chase handed the pistol to Doug, then took it back and handed it to Veek. He ignored Doug's whines and went back to Murdoch, sliding his hand into the man's left pocket. He didn't need to go deep. A small key ring sat near the top, holding a single, thin, silver key. Seth gave him the handcuffs and they ordered Murdoch to turn around. The man obeyed and brought one of his arms down. Chase took a moment to work the cuffs open and around the man's wrist.
Make them tight, said Veek. Some of them are stronger than they look.
Chase squeezed the cuff and it ratcheted down onto Murdoch's wrist. The second arm came down and the other cuff tightened, pinching his skin. His fingers spasmed, a quick flex open, long enough for Chase to get a glimpse of something hidden there.
Whoa, he murmured. Do we have a light out here?
Veek stepped aside to allow more light from the building. Doug swiped his hands across his tablet and flipped the bright white screen toward their prisoner. Murdoch tried to press his fingers back together, pulled them into tight little cups, but Chase pulled at them until the other man relented. Murdoch let out a little sigh, then spread his fingers as wide as the cuffs would allow. In the harsh light of the tablet, the membranes almost looked white. They stretched between the last knuckle of each finger with soft, curved edges. Chase could see a vein stretching through the one that reached between Murdoch's thumb and index finger. Seth traded a quick look with Chase. Chase shrugged and shook his head.
You should have seen the other one they had watching me, Veek said.
Seth put a hand on Murdoch's shoulder and marched him toward the building. As they approached, Alex stepped outside. His face twisted up when they walked their prisoner into the light.
Is there somewhere we can lock him up?
Asked Chase. Alex crossed his arms. He's part of the family. We're not letting him near the machine.
Okay, is there another room we can...
We're not letting him inside.
Chase stared at Alex, then glanced at Veek. She shrugged.
The whole building is more or less the machine.
Are you serious?
Remember what you said about old machines filling a gymnasium?
So what do we do with him?
Alex pointed a finger off toward the side of the building. There's a drain pipe on the northeast corner. Chain him to it.
We can't just leave him out here, said Chase. What if he starts yelling or something?
I'm not having him near the machine. He's part of the family, which means he can't be trusted. Any disruption could be fatal at this point.
I'm not part of the family, though, said Murdoch. He turned his head to look at each of them as best he could. I swear.
Veek glared at him.
Oh, really?
Murdoch rolled his oversized eyes.
I mean, yeah, I am. By nature, I can't help that. But look, even as a kid, I thought the whole doomsday religion was messed up. I haven't believed any of that stuff in years. I never did.
Still not believing you, said Veek.
Well, I mean,
he paused.
I know it's real. I've seen the Harbingers and the Seraphs and even one of the big ones. I just don't believe the religion part of it. I don't think it's all some divine plan or part of a greater good. I mean, I know Ebola's real. It doesn't mean I think Ebola running wild all over the world is a great thing that's supposed to happen.
That's a creepy analogy, said Doug.
Look, I can tell you whatever you want to know about the family.
Do you know where they are on the island?
Asked Chase. Murdoch rolled his eyes again. It made Chase uneasy, watching them move in their sockets. When they finished, Murdoch jerked his chin at the apartment building.
They're searching for this place, I'm guessing. I couldn't tell you exactly where they are at the moment. I left to find you.
Sent out to recapture the prisoner?
Sneered Veek.
No, but, well, yes. But it gave me time to think. Honestly, I don't like any of these people. I just wanted to go home, and then I saw the big one.
Squeal,
said Veek. His big eyelids slapped down and up again in a huge blink.
What?
We call them squales. Squid whales makes them easier to deal with.
I doubt that, grumbled Seth. I'm not even sure they're still here, said Murdoch. He turned to Veek again. I went back to the yacht, and it's gone. The others may have seen the squale was already here and just decided to go home.
Wait, said Chase. They didn't know it was out?
Murdoch shook his head.
They didn't do something to let it out?
No. When I left them to look for Veek, they hadn't found the other pole of the machine, this place. And they still haven't, right?
We've been here about an hour now, said Veek. Maybe a little more.
Chase looked up at Alex, still at the top of the steps. The last light had faded from the sky, and he was almost a silhouette in the bright doorway.
You said this place was protecting the world, that they couldn't get through.
Alex nodded once.
Yes.
The word came out tired, exhausted. So what's going on? If the family didn't set the squale loose, who did? The silhouette didn't move.
Well,
we should discuss this, said Alex. Back inside, away from him. Chase took in a breath to argue, let it out, and looked at Murdoch. His gaze wandered to Veek. She shrugged. He turned to Seth.
Can you?
The crewman nodded.
I'll watch him, at least until we figure out what we're going to do with him, or until that thing comes back.
Chase and Veek headed for the staircase. Alex cleared his throat.
Just you, Mr. Chase.
What? Seriously?
Said Veek. She crossed her arms and glared up at the silhouette.
Boys' club? Now? Do we have time for this? The Alpha, your squale, should not return for another 2 or 3 hours.
I just require a few minutes with Mr. Chase.
It's just Chase. He turned back to Vig. You good with this?
No, so make it quick. None of us wants to get stuck out here.
Chase walked up the concrete stairs and Alex stepped aside, holding the door open. They walked back into the warmth of the giant antique radio, and Alex led him down one of the catwalks past the stairs and toward the center of the machine.
From things you said earlier, I gather you are some kind of electrical engineer?
That's being generous. I'm more of a repairman.
A repairman who grasped the basics of the machine in just a few minutes.
The bare basics? What's your point?
In our own way, we are both men of science. We deal with facts and absolutes, unhindered by personal bias or sentiment. Because of this, I am hoping you are also a trustworthy person.
What are you getting at? Alex pressed his hands together and raised his fingertips to his lips.
How well do you know your companion, Miss Veek?
I'm pretty sure it's just Veek, and as well as any of us knows each other, I guess.
She was on the ship with you?
Chase shook his head. No, we met here. Right after we saw you on the beach with the squale. Alex sighed at the term.
I see.
What? What is it between you two?
I do not believe Miss Veek is who she claims to be.
What? Why?
She claims to be employed at the Los Angeles end of the machine, yet she doesn't recognize me.
Why would she? Do you have a video link or something?
I have a brother who works there.
Do you look a lot alike?
For all intents and purposes, we are twins.
Well, Chase looked around the arrays of vacuum tubes and circuitry. This is a big place. Maybe they work in different sections or they're on different shifts. She just might not know him well enough to recognize you.
Doubtful, but I must confess, it is only one of my reasons not to trust her.
Okay. Alex cast a slow look around them.
Someone has been sabotaging the Los Angeles end of the machine.
What?
For several years now, there have been erratic surges, brief shutdowns, interference. I've often been able to compensate from here, but there have been many close calls, and now I fear there has been a catastrophic failure. Perhaps a deliberate failure.
Chase mulled it over. You think that's how the squales got out?
Not out. In.
But you think it happened because someone sabotaged the other end of the machine?
I only know the Los Angeles end had become more and more unstable, and now one of the squales is here.
And there, Doug was watching a news report this morning. One of them was in Los Angeles, too.
This morning?
At least 12 hours ago. Alex closed his eyes. He trembled on his feet. For a moment, Chase thought the man was close to passing out. Then he opened his eyes.
You see my concern, then. The machine fails on that end. The family arrives here on my island, and with them is a member of the Los Angeles staff, someone who does not know my brother and seems to have only a passing knowledge of the machine's functions.
Someone they kidnapped?
So she says. I am familiar with the family. Their nature makes them lean towards deception and trickery. It is not uncommon for them to infiltrate a target.
She was running through the jungle, handcuffed.
Which made you believe her claims?
Chase thought back to Veek stumbling out of the woods. What are you suggesting?
I think perhaps Mr. Murdoch should not be restrained alone.
Oh, come on.
I don't believe we can trust her near the machine.
Chase shook his head. Sorry, no. I don't think either of you is telling me everything, but I still trust her.
As I said, these are the facts I have. Tell me, what other direction could they be pointing?
I don't know, but one way or another, she knows about all of this, and I think we need all the in-the-know people we can get right now.
It's simply too big a risk, says you.
A cough behind him stopped the conversation. Alex's expression stiffened. Chase looked over his shoulder. Veek stood by the door a few yards away, watching them. The pistol they'd taken from Murdoch hung at her waist, half covered by her coat.
"We've got things to do and I got bored waiting for your boys' club to wrap up," she said.
She looked at Alex, then Chase.
"Anything I should know about?"
29. Chase said nothing. Neither did Alex. They both stared at Veek. She stared back.
"If a squail's loose, we don't have time to stand around," she said. "So if there's something I can do that'll speed this up..."
Another long silence. Chase shook his head and waved a hand up at the walls of spun wire and glass. "Do you work at the Los Angeles end of this thing?" Her face wrinkled up.
"What?"
He looked back at Alex. The other man scowled at him. "He thinks you might be some kind of plant or spy or something." Veek squinted at Alex.
"If I was," she said, "you'd be pretty stupid to just tell me you were suspicious."
"Not the dumbest thing I've ever done. So, are you?"
"If I'm a spy, I'm just going to lie anyway."
Chase shrugged.
"If either of you is telling the truth, we're heading towards the end of the world. I'm going to go out on a limb and trust you."
She snorted, but her shoulders slumped a bit as she did. She pulled the holster off her hip, stepped forward, and handed it to Chase.
"You're probably more comfortable with this than me."
He took it, nodded, slid the holster onto his jeans. Veek looked at Alex.
"I work at the Kavach building in Los Angeles. Nikola Tesla named it that. He's the one who actually built this place, right?"
Chase blinked and looked between them.
"Seriously? Tesla?" "Please," Alex said. "Continue."
She looked around and pointed up into the machine.
"Assuming both of them have the same layout, where you were earlier is the main controls. Storeroom is back there. My partner and I live right over there."
"So you do have a partner?"
"We have a whole team. But I meant partner in the other sense."
"Ah, a husband."
"No. Marriage is an obsolete convention that reduces women to property."
Alex furrowed his brow, the expression of a college professor three times his age facing down a rebellious student.
"And which systems are you responsible for?"
"What now?"
"You work on the machine. Which systems are yours?"
Veek glared at the man.
"The needles."
"Needles?"
She waved a hand at the control area.
"We keep the needles at zero."
"Yes, but what do you do?"
"That's what we do."
Alex's face shifted. It took Chase a moment to place the new expression. He'd seen it a few times back in Houston just after the hurricane. Alex had just made a horrible discovery, and they were watching him wade through shock and denial at the same time. He started to say, then swallowed the words down.
"My brother isn't there, is he?"
"Your brother?"
Alex's eyes got even wider. He pressed his lips together and took a few quick, short breaths through his nose. He grabbed his hands, released them, grabbed them again.
"He says he's got an almost twin brother who works there in Los Angeles," explained Chase. "It's why he thought you'd know him."
"Surely someone there knows him," said Alex. "Someone has met him, has been trained by him."
Veek shook her head.
"No meetings, no training."
"None?"
"Are you sure?" asked Chase.
"Very sure," she said. "Sorry to break it to you, but from everything we know, the LA machine went almost 100 years with nobody managing it. I mean, there were people taking care of the building, but they just thought it was, you know, an apartment building. Nobody knew about the machine."
"But you do."
"We found it by accident. Figured out what it was. realized somebody needed to take care of it.
She shrugged.
We've just been winging it, figuring things out as we go.
Alex swallowed.
100 years?
She nodded. He stared up into the machine.
So this has been a doomed venture all along. Without a trained crew there, the machine's failure was inevitable, and here we are.
When was your brother supposed to be there?
Asked Chase.
When did he start working there? Maybe they just never overlapped.
The other man sighed.
That's a complicated question. I don't think you'd believe me.
It's been a crazy day, said Chase. I can't imagine you could say much that'd surprise me.
I can take a guess,
said Veek.
You and your brother, you're related to Alexander Kotorovich, aren't you?
Alex's eyes went wide again.
Who?
Asked Chase.
The guy who designed this machine 100 years ago and built it with Tesla,
she said.
Since I didn't travel through time, I'm guessing Alex here is his, what, great-grandson? Great-grand-nephew, maybe?
Alex coughed out a bitter laugh.
No. Alexander Kotorovich was the man I called father, but he had no children.
Okay, said Chase. That sentence needs some explaining.
The other man sighed, took a breath, straightened up.
Father realized there would be a need for him. People would try to undermine his work. Groups like the Family of the Red Death would work actively against it.
Veek nodded.
Been there, seen that. So he devised a plan to extend his influence, a project he worked on parallel to the machine. There is a botanical process he'd been studying, one where duplicates of a plant are propagated from cuttings. What is not generally understood is that these are exact duplicates, down to a genetic level. One is not growing a new plant in the traditional sense. One is growing an identical copy of the same plant.
The words sparked a random image in Chase's mind. A vague memory of a young, dreadlocked scientist with glasses explaining scientific concepts to a group of her friends. It took him a moment to remember where he'd seen the young woman. On a BBC America show his wife, Elizabeth, had been addicted to. The show about...
Wait, he said. Are you telling us you're a clone?
Oh, said Alex. He let out a small sigh of relief. You're familiar with the concept.
30.
You know what? Veek said. You're right. I don't believe this, and I live inside a giant steampunk machine that projects force fields around the Earth.
I assure you, said Alex.
It is the truth.
But, okay, this still doesn't make a lot of sense, said Chase. If I'm understanding all of this, you're still too young to be a clone of...
He glanced at Veek.
Alexander Kotorovich.
Thanks.
I am a clone,
said Alex.
But I am not the first. Father's experiments yielded 14 viable embryos.
14? Said Veek.
Seriously? Yes. He divided them between the two ends of the machine and established a creche in each. Estimating a useful period of 50 years per body meant I would have, optimistically, 350 years at each location. So the older version of you I met, said Veek, he was the earlier clone, the one that came before you. In a manner of speaking, from a strict linear point of view, yes, but the Alexander you met is...
But even taking age out of it, interrupted Chase, a clone's just biology. Even if you were a perfect double of your father, you wouldn't have his knowledge, his memories, his personality. You'd still be a different person.
Alex nodded once.
Correct. I realized this. Father came to realize this as well. Fortunately, that was a much easier problem to solve.
He simply made a device to copy the electrochemical structures and patterns of the brain from one individual to another. He what? In all fairness, Nikolai helped with some of the finer details to ensure there was no degradation between copies.
Yeah, said Vic, back to not believing any of this. There are some limitations. The process requires a certain degree of development within the target brain. 11 years is a good minimum. 14 is ideal, but as of yet, ideal conditions have been rare.
Chase thought of Dina, 3 months from her 10th birthday.
What do you mean?
Alex gestured behind him and down.
The children born from the creche are still children. They age no faster.
To get the brain to an 11-year state of development requires 11 years. It is a constant balancing act. I never want to let a child out of the creche too early and have to transfer before it is truly necessary. By the same token, however, when it is truly necessary, there is rarely the luxury of an 11-year wait.
So you...
Vic's head seemed to sink into her shoulders.
You're the Alexander Kotorovich?
For all intents and purposes, yes.
And you're 150 years old?
My consciousness is, yes, 161 years.
He gestured at his chest.
This body is only 23, though.
So if you've got all the same memories, if you're him, why do you keep calling him father?
It cuts down on confusion during conversations like this one, among other reasons.
Do you have a lot of conversations like this?
She asked. 11 years, Chase echoed.
The graveyard.
Ah, said Alex.
Yes, you saw it.
What graveyard?
Asked Vic. When we first got here, we followed something into the jungle. One of those monster men with the extra arms and all the teeth.
Seraphs,
Vic and Alex said at the same time.
Right, anyway.
We found a graveyard with a couple of tombstones. No names, but they all had 3 dates. The middle one was always about 11 years after the first one.
No names are needed, said Alex, because I am the only one buried there. My personal graveyard, where I've buried myself 4 times.
Something about the graves tickled Chase's mind. But there was one other one, the only one with a name.
Yes, Charles Martin.
Right, he died before the clones. Alex gave a polite nod.
He was one of the workers who helped with the construction of the machine. Mason, I believe. We had a camp a short ways from here with almost 12 tents.
So what happened to him?
Asked Vic.
Why did he get buried here and not, I don't know, shipped home or something?
Martin was one of the last to leave, Alex explained. He was a good man with a quick mind, so he stayed behind to help with final preparations before we...
No, the gravestones still gnawed at Chase's mind. That's not right. Charles Martin was a kid. He was only 9 years old when he died. Vic blinked.
What?
His tombstone. I remembered it because he was pretty much the same age as my daughter Dina when she died. Vic caught her breath. Alex's face shifted. Then it shifted again, softening into an all-too-familiar expression of sympathy. But Chase had seen the first look on his face, the look in his eyes, worry with a bit of frustration around the mouth.
I'm sorry,
said Vic.
It was 2 years ago. It's okay.
But it wasn't okay. The dates on the stones, all the gravestones, not just Martin's, still gnawed at him. He remembered what Seth had said about Alex, about his body language, about not trusting him. About the wooden blocks they'd found, the blocks with Greek letters and Roman numerals on them, the classics.
Who was Charles Martin?
Chase asked.
Who was he really?
He was just what I said, a worker here who helped.
What happened to him? Alex's expression reverted back to frustration. This isn't relevant right now.
If we're deciding who to trust, said Veek, I think it's very relevant.
Alex crossed his arms and tapped his fingers against one bicep, uncrossed them, paced a few feet down the catwalk, walked back.
We were under a tight schedule, he said. The field the machine produces counteracts certain effects that occur when the human population passes a certain threshold. These effects are what attract the alpha predators and allow them to pass through into our world. I had made the calculations based off known population growth figures at the time. We had a target date for activating the machine and a projected date for reaching the population threshold. We were short on time. Achieving the activation date required supervision at both sites.
So you made the clones, said Veek. He shook his head.
No, as I explained. The creche children were developed alongside the project. They aged at a normal rate. At best, I could put my mind into a 15-month-old body with an undeveloped brain. It would cause dozens of problems.
He turned his head away from them and looked up into the heart of the machine. The tombstones stopped gnawing at Chase.
You used Martin, he said. You used the mind machine and copied yourself into him.
Yes, Alex said. It had to be done. I did tests of all the viable men on the island, and when I had the results, Martin volunteered for the process.
I bet he did,
muttered Veek.
So what happened to him?
Asked Chase, although he already suspected what the answer would be.
To his mind, his memories, his personality.
The copying process, by its nature, replaces all the existing information in the target brain with my own. It is much like bleaching the paper pages of a book and printing new words on them. The original information is gone forever.
You overwrote him,
said Veek.
Like reformatting a hard drive.
Yes. As I said, it had to be done.
Chase punched him in the face. His arm shook with rage. He'd never been much of a fighter, but most of his fist still managed to connect with most of Alex's nose. The other man staggered back and caught himself on the catwalk's wooden rail before he fell.
What the hell?
Shouted Veek. She grabbed Chase's arm before he could deliver another punch. Blood dribbled out from one of Alex's nostrils. He reached up, touched it, then examined his red fingertips. He glared at Chase. Chase shook his arm free of Veek's grip. His breath came out in quick, hot gasps. His blood tingled and urged him to attack again, to do anything. Veek backhanded his arm, then smacked it again.
Seriously,
she snapped.
What the hell's wrong with you?
Don't you get it?
Chase yelled. She flinched, but only in her shoulders. Her eyes never wavered. He took a breath, tried to calm the speed bag pummeling his ribcage.
He's been doing this to kids. They need to be at least 11 years old, right? All the toys we found. He lets them grow up, lets them be kids, and then he erases their brains and keeps himself alive.
Veek opened her mouth to speak, said nothing, and then slowly turned to stare at Alex. He wiped a thin stream of blood from his upper lip. He straightened up and looked Chase square in the eye.
It was necessary. Bullshit. I needed to be here to maintain the machine, and there, in Los Angeles. Bullshit,
Chase shouted again.
You could have taught somebody what you know. You could have taught them. I couldn't take the chance.
Alex looked at Veek.
You understand what's at stake here. I couldn't risk teaching someone else and hoping I taught them everything I knew, that I'd prepared them for every possible scenario. I couldn't hope their minds would grasp the full extent of the concepts and ideas behind the machine. It had to be me.
Chase shook his head.
So you killed children. Do you think I don't know that?
Yelled Alex.
Do you believe it somehow escaped me when I raised them as my own sons? Do you understand how many times I've blinked and opened my eyes in a new body? Looked at an older version of myself staring down at me. Do you think I never regretted it?
His shout echoed through the machine. Vic looked away from him. She shifted her feet and leaned ever so slightly away from him. Chase unclenched his fists. Alex let out his own shaking breath. He pulled a threadbare handkerchief from one of his vest pockets, blotted another thread of blood from his lip, then wiped the edge of his hand clean. He finished with the handkerchief, stuffed it back into his vest pocket.
If I could have done something else, anything else, I would have. But I knew what would happen to the world if I did not, so I did what was necessary.
But it wasn't,
Vic said.
You built it. The machine's so good it went on without you, without anyone, for decades. It didn't need your supervision.
Another silence stretched out between them. Then shouting and gunfire came from the far side of the machine. 31. Katanga pushed through the tall weeds, shifting small branches aside, stepping around the larger trees. He tried to move silently through the forest, like the heroes of the books and movies he devoured in his free time. One after another, he cycled through as many of their tips and lessons as he could remember. He couldn't find a single sign of Ayman, Seth, or the others. Granted, he was wandering through a forest at night, but once his eyes had adjusted to the darkness, he felt like he should find something. Some footprints, a broken stick, an overturned rock. Lord, he hated nature, loathed it with a passion. Ever since he'd gotten out of his village, nothing but cities for him. His beloved Makara was, had been, a beautiful, mechanized home. Lights, heat, shelter, nature kept at a healthy distance by a double hull of steel. He hated nature, yes, but even if he hadn't, the island made his skin crawl. The forest somehow muffled the booming thunderstorm that had accompanied the tentacled dragon beast in the sky. And the wind, even the waves on the shore less than half a mile behind him. And the forest itself was silent. No hooting animals or birds, no buzzing insects. Despite all his efforts, every footstep Katanga took seemed to echo between the trees. Fucking nature. He slumped against a tree and rested his legs. They still felt cold and stiff and tired. When he found the others, they could carry him while he slept for 10 hours. Or they could all keep running from the monster. As the sobering thought passed through his mind, dragging a double handful of grim implications behind it, something made his ears itch. Instinct made him wave the bug away, but a second later his tired, on-edge brain processed the sound, not the buzz of an insect distorted by the silence. Voices. A distant conversation. Finally. He pushed off the tree, took in a breath to call out, and his legs reminded him to save that breath from moving. Much easier on his throat as well to call out once he was closer to them. Better than wasting his strength on a few weak shouts they might not hear, even in the eerily quiet jungle. He took a second breath and headed in the direction of the voices. A few minutes passed and he feared they'd moved on. His pace felt pitifully slow and he worried they'd outdistance him. But no. There they were.
Just past a small grove of bamboo, a voice in American English. One of the passengers, then. Either Chaser or the annoying one. And the quick flash of an electric torch. He could almost make out the words. Then someone answered, and Katanga came to a dead stop. Had that been a woman's voice? What was a woman doing out here? Where had she come from? A few years under Hagen's command as a smuggler, even a part-time one, had given Katanga a healthy sense of caution. It also taught him the biggest problems, as he'd quickly learned, often came from the smallest of things. A misspoken word, an overlooked detail, a poorly timed glance. Sensing and identifying those elements helped avoid problems. The sound of the woman's voice in the woods set off those same warnings. The woman was a problem, which meant her group was a problem. He slowed his pace. It let him move quieter, and it made sure he didn't suddenly stumble into the people ahead of him. Another torch beam panned through the trees. A dozen branches and bamboo stalks broke it up before it reached him, but he froze anyway. The male voice, no, a different male voice, was talking again.
I agree with Barnabas, said the voice. We're going in circles.
I didn't say that, this from the first voice he'd heard. I just said I think we've passed this tree before.
Which means we're going in circles, said the female voice.
No, it doesn't, said Barnabas. Katanga crept closer. His feet drifted inches above the ground, quietly pushing grass and twigs out of their way. His knees bent, turning his stride into more of a crouch.
Well, how else do you explain it? Asked the first voice. This island's not that damned big, and we've been walking for hours.
The torch cut through the woods again. Katanga sank even lower, ducking his head and hitting his butt on the heels of his boots. He froze as the grass around him became a weave of light and shadows. A new voice cut in, deep, another woman. She sounded big, and maybe just a few yards away.
Are you doubting the seraphs?
Another sound echoed through the forest, a sort of wet, rattling purr, or maybe a growl. Katanga couldn't tell if it was a person or an animal. The beams of light swept back to their source, and now he could see them. The flickering lights and shadows gave them huge eye sockets and overly sharp features. At least six people. The light jiggled and bounced between the trees, making it hard to count how many, especially while some of them were pacing around and creating shadow twins. It gave him the sense they'd just stopped for a rest, not to make camp for the night.
Of course I'm not, said the man's voice. Is it possible they don't understand what we're looking for?
I thought I was clear with them,
said a new voice, another woman. This one's voice had the tones of command, someone casually used to having their requests carried out.
But it's possible we misunderstood each other.
One of the torch beams hit something and reflected enough light to show the speaker. A good-looking white woman, perhaps a bit younger than Katanga. Big, dark eyes, a long braid, a little skinny for his taste. Her shirt hung open, unbuttoned, and in the indirect light her pale skin almost glowed. She turned to one of the trees and spoke in a language he didn't recognize. Lots of deep sounds from back in the throat. It had a flowing quality that reminded him of Arabic or Farsi, but he knew enough of each language to be sure it wasn't either of them. The tree unfolded in the wavering light. Katanga bit back a gasp. He reached up and pressed a hand over his mouth to make sure he didn't cry out. The cracked and streaked leather of the creature's cloak had hidden it. Now that it moved, Katanga could see its gaunt shape and the unnatural way the cloak sat on its shoulders. It looked down at the woman from inside an oversized, shadowed hood. It spoke back in the same language, and the light gleamed on dozens of needle-like teeth as it did. Too many teeth to actually fit inside a mouth. While it spoke, two other trees shifted and turned.
more of the things. Katanga kept getting quick glimpses as the light bounced and reflected. He got the sense the people with the torches were trying not to shine them onto the tall creatures. Without moving his head, his eyes went left and right, examining the dark outlines of the trees near him. The woman in charge spoke more with the hooded creature, and it continued to respond. Gestures passed between them. Katanga watched the back and forth as best he could. Part of him wanted to move closer and get a better view, but another part responded with a gut animal instinct to stay away. The same instincts that warned you not to move closer to rattlesnakes or crocodiles or sharks. He peered closer through the tall grass. At first, he'd assumed the wavering lights and shadows were tricking his eyes. The longer he watched, though, the more he became certain that there were too many hands gesturing in that conversation. A low burn worked its way through his thighs. He'd been crouching for a few minutes. He leaned cautiously one way, then the other, trying to ease the pressure a bit. The good-looking woman sighed and turned away from the hooded monster.
"We have had a misunderstanding," she told the others.
One of the other women let out a low groan. The others turned to glare at her. She cowered and lowered her head. Dark stains covered one side of her shirt.
"The Seraphs won't approach the pole. They say there's... I think the gist of what they're saying is there's too much wrongness there for them. They don't like it, and assumed we wouldn't either, so they've been guiding us around its perimeter."
"So we have been," the man started to say.
"Yes, Judah, we've been walking in circles. You were right."
"Apologies, Minister." Judah bowed his head. The title rang in Katanga's ears. What religion had their minister, a female minister at that, walk around with their clothes hanging open and converse with monsters? His life had always revolved around the sea. From his boyhood in his shitty Somali village to almost 2 decades on 5 different ships as a legitimate crew member. The sea had its own legends and folktales. A minister with monsters in her congregation fit well into more than a few of the stories he'd heard.
"We're going to have to take the lead," the minister said. "If I understand them correctly, we need to head that way. They say we can't miss the pole. It's huge."
She pointed with one hand through the dark forest, the fingers all straight out like a blade. Katanga felt a momentary relief she wasn't pointing in his direction.
"And they definitely know what we're looking for? Are you doubting too, Claudia?"
Claudia, the groaning woman, shook her head.
"I just want our task to be completed," she said with great sincerity.
The minister smiled.
"The pole is what drew the Seraphs to this place. They don't know what it is, but they understand we're looking for it."
A collection of satisfied noises came from the group. They reshouldered packs, and a few of them took up rifles. They pushed on into the forest. The tall creatures waited, then, almost reluctantly, fell in behind them. Katanga let them go on ahead. The circles of torchlight jumped and skittered off through the trees. The sounds of rustling grass and the occasional snapping twig grew faint. He stayed in his crouch, despite his aching legs. He studied the shadowy trees around him. How high up did they go? He pictured himself straightening up and one of the tree trunks splitting apart, throwing open its cloak like spreading wings. The ache in his legs progressed to actual pain. They'd been through too much in the past few hours. He gritted his teeth behind his lips and counted to 20. The trees didn't move. He leaned forward, gave his muscles a bit of room, and pushed himself to his feet. Nothing. He turned his head and saw the distant flickers of light broken up by tall weeds and bamboo shafts. The minister and her group were at least 100 yards away, moving at a slow but steady pace through the forest. In another few minutes, they'd be gone, leaving him alone in the dark woods. Something about the minister gnawed him, not in a good way. Her monsters scared him, not terrified, but close. He didn't know how or why they were on the island or what it was they were searching for. He did know they were the only other living creatures he'd seen or even heard since washing up here. So, he followed them. At a healthy distance. He tried to stay low as he moved in case they directed the lights back behind them, and he didn't move unless he could see at least 2 torch beams up ahead. In too many stories he'd read, someone would hide and wait behind to catch pursuers. He knew it wouldn't help him if one of the tall things hid in the darkness, but it made him feel safer. Better to take a few weak precautions than no precautions at all. After 30 minutes of Katanga half-crawling through the undergrowth, the lights up ahead came to a halt. He glimpsed quick flickers now being directed even farther forward. The words reaching him sounded excited, hopeful. He inched forward a little more. A new set of sounds echoed through the dark forest. The loud, yawning creak reminded Katanga of rope stretching between a ship and a dock. Right behind it came the sounds of snapping branches, something rushing through the tall grass, ending with a pair of hollow, wooden thuds. Then the screaming started. The lights swung around wildly. Someone wailed. It might have been a man. Katanga scuttled forward, gambling that the noise and disarray would hide any faint noises he might make. He skirted wide, trying to come up alongside the minister and her group. The torch beams gave him glimpses of a clearing in the trees and the strangers clustered at the edge of it. He inched closer. 2 logs, each one easily as thick around as his chest, hung like giant swings at the end of long ropes. The branches on each one had been cut short and sharpened, or maybe they were stakes that had been hammered into them. The logs still swayed a few feet above the ground with spent movement. He couldn't be positive from this angle, but Katanga felt pretty sure they were hung at chest height. The bodies supported this idea. The man propped up against one of the palm trees had 2 large, bloody holes in his shirt, and the chest beneath the shirt had a shallow, irregular shape. Blood coated his lips, chin, and collar, as if the impact had squeezed a quart out of him all at once. A torch beam lit up a woman sprawled on the ground, limbs splayed and her forehead caved in like a deflated football. She'd probably caught the log in the face as it swung down. Another man, the one called Judah, flopped on the ground like a fish on the deck of a ship. His mouth opened and closed as he let out silent gasps of agony. One of his arms had at least 3 new joints, and his shoulder didn't look much better. The big woman examined him, and her torch revealed a gouge on his cheek, spilling blood across the side of his face. The minister stood there, glaring. Not worried or scared, not horrified or sad at the loss of half her group. The torch beams bounced up to underlight her face and emphasize her furious features. It made her as much a monster as the tall things. Where had the tall creatures gotten to? He didn't see any of their bodies, so they'd escaped the booby trap. Had they lapsed back into stillness despite all the chaos, blending into the forest?
"Leave now," a man's voice called out through the trees. "I have no wish to kill you, but we all know what is at stake."
The minister whipped her torch around, aiming it out into the clearing. Katanga caught a glimpse of something huge covered in vines, an old wall, or maybe a building. As the torch's beam shifted, one of the tall things unfolded from behind a tree, a dark shadow hurling its spear toward the building. A sharp echo of wood on wood rang back at them. Silence followed it.
"He won't let us leave, no matter what."
Katanga recognized the voice as the one called Barnabas. The torch beam swung back to light him up. He had a skull face with 2 slits for a nose and round, dark eyes.
"He can't risk us telling others and coming back in force." "We came in force this time,"
muttered the big woman crouched by Judah.
Get their weapons,
snapped the minister. She pointed at the two bodies. After a moment, she swung her accusing finger over to point at Judah as well.
Can you still fight?
He gritted his teeth and nodded. The big woman helped him to his feet. Judah swayed in the dim light, but Katanga recognized the fire in the man's eyes. Above all things, he was a zealot, willing to die for the cause.
Should we wait for Murdoch to return?
Asked Barnabas. His tone told Katanga it was a required question, not a serious one. The minister's face ran through a few expressions before she shook her head.
No, he's useless in a fight.
The big woman looked back through the trees toward the building.
Who is that old man?
The minister scowled at her.
Who do you think? He's the adversary, evil incarnate. He's the one who built this thing.